I want you to open your Bible now to a passage in Deuteronomy. One of the interesting things about prisons, of course, is that in the Old Testament there weren't any. But the Old Testament does have a lot to say about the punishment of criminals, especially in the book of Deuteronomy. And I've just picked out one paragraph, Deuteronomy 25, verses 1 to 3, to give you a perspective on what the Bible has to say on that subject. So let's hear God's word as it's recorded in Deuteronomy 25, 1 to 3. When men have a dispute, they are to take it to court, and the judges will decide the case, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty. If the guilty man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall make him lie down and have him flogged in his presence with the number of lashes his crime deserves. But he must not give him more than 40 lashes. If he's flogged more than that, your brother will be degraded in your eyes. What is prison for? Just about everybody, with the possible exception of Michael Howard, who knows anything about prisons, is worried about our prison system and feels it is seriously failing. This is how Roger Shaw, who's a chief probation officer in Mid Wales and a former research fellow here at the University of Cambridge in criminology, this is how he expresses his uncertainty about it. If an intelligence with no knowledge of earthly things came down from outer space and viewed the justice systems of the developed nations and saw how we gathered the vulnerable, those with poor social skills and little education, but with some experience of delinquency, and herded them together in institutions with other disadvantaged people and a sprinkling of serious criminals, then to release them at a later date, possibly to no home, probably to no job, and definitely to be labelled by the outside world as jailbirds and criminals. The intelligence might be forgiven for thinking we were actually trying to increase crime rather than reduce it. He, she, or it would not have to engage in very much serious research to demonstrate that this is exactly what we are doing. The trouble with prisons, you see, is that we try to do too much through them. Prisons are usually regarded as fulfilling five purposes. The trouble is they are mutually incompatible purposes, purposes which you can't achieve through a single institution. One purpose of a prison is retribution. Prisons are places where crime is punished. To achieve that, a prison has to be a place of suffering. In the ancient world, of course, that suffering might be physical torture. 50 years ago, it might have been hard labour on some kind of building site. These days, more likely, it's the suffering of deprivation. Deprivation of freedom, of leisure, of material goods, of company, and so forth. But to be places of retribution, prisons must be places of suffering in some respect. Secondly, many would argue that prisons should be a place of atonement. That is, a place where people are encouraged to feel sorry for what they've done. That's the origin of the American word penitentiary, of course. A prison is a place where people should be made penitent for their crimes. And for a prison to achieve that purpose, a prison must be a place of humiliation, a place of shame. That may involve subjecting the prisoner to degrading or abusive treatment. In the ancient world, again, the criminal might be placed in the stocks and the local yobos throw vegetables at them. These days, it might be more a matter of not having private toilet facilities and being subjected to the rather degrading routine of slopping out your cell. The third goal of a prison is deterrence. A prisoner is there to discourage other people in the community from committing offences. You could argue that to achieve that purpose, a prison must, to some extent at any rate, be a place of horror. It must be a place where nobody wants to go. That might mean that it should look forbidding and unattractive, that it should have high walls and barbed wire. It must look forbidding. Its image must be one that is, at least in some sense, horrific, if it is to deter people. A fourth purpose is the protection of the public. Some prisoners are obviously dangerous and must be prevented from reoffending. In order to achieve that purpose, a prison must be a place of security. Maybe the prison will have to be an escape-proof fortress, located in some inhospitable location like Dartmoor, and maybe even with its perimeter with armed guards mounted. And fifthly, a prison has to be a place of rehabilitation, at least so many would argue. On top of all these other purposes, in our century it has been strongly urged that prisons should be places where people are so re-educated that they do not desire to re-offend, but are rather reformed as a result of their stay in prison. This may involve group psychotherapy. That's a technique much favoured in Scandinavia. In this country, under the influence of behaviourist psychology, it's more likely to involve something akin to the short, sharp shock that we heard so much about a few years ago. The Borstal institutions use discipline as a way of trying to inculcate in their inmates some new sense of self-worth and dignity that will prevent them from the slide into criminality when they leave. Prisons, if they're to be places of rehabilitation, must communicate to their inmates a sense of hope. Now, there are moral dangers in all of these five purposes, actually. Rehabilitation, for instance, if the purpose of a prison is to rehabilitate someone so they are reformed, well, how far can you go in your techniques of rehabilitation? Is it okay to brainwash a prisoner? Is it okay to do a brain operation on a violent prisoner to take away their violence? How far are you allowed to go to rehabilitate the prisoner, to prevent them from reoffending? If deterrence is the purpose of a prison, well, does that mean that any amount of punishment is okay if it succeeds in deterring? The same could be said for all these other purposes of a prison if you push them too far, too relentlessly. But the major problem with a prison, as I said just now, is that it's quite impossible for a single institution to achieve all these five goals satisfactorily and simultaneously. In particular, rehabilitation is not really compatible with the demands of retribution, atonement, deterrence, and the protection of the public. And that becomes abundantly clear when you begin to probe how actually prisons function in practice. Liffey's given us a good picture of that. Many authors, of course, have described their personal experiences in prison, and many sociological surveys have been done, and they all reveal the same general features. Prisoners feel prisons to be repressive places. The need to prevent escapes and forestall assaults and thefts means that prisoners are kept under constant surveillance, and a system of rigid rules and repetitive checks and routine searches in many prisons is commonplace. The minute regulation of life makes prison feel like a highly authoritarian society in which meaningful activity is usually rather minimal. Whatever may be said about rehabilitation, in practice, the needs of security tend to come first. Furthermore, prisons feel degrading to the vast majority of prisoners. We've mentioned the lack of secure toilet facilities, which means prisoners in some of our prisons must still slop out every morning. There are many other aspects of prison which are degrading. Enforced celibacy leads to a great deal of homosexual abuse in our prisons. Although the statistics of this are not clear in this country, some work in the States has exposed that a young and vulnerable male prisoner is extremely likely to be the victim of homosexual rape within their first month inside the average American prison. What's more, the sadistic traits which are in so many human beings tend to find themselves rather concentrated in prison, both in the prisoners and sometimes in their warders. Though this is changing, it has to be said that up until fairly recently, an awful lot of warders came out of military service. There's a hierarchy, actually, among prisoners, which many people comment on, and invariably in that hierarchy, violent criminals, those who are inside for crimes of serious violence, are on the top, and sex offenders are at the bottom, and everybody else is smeared out in between. That pecking order gives rise to a huge amount of degrading treatment for those who are lower down on the rungs. Thirdly, prisons feel corrupting. The only way you can preserve order in a prison is by some kind of conspiracy between the staff and the inmates. There's no way you can deny that. If any of you remember the series called Porridge on the TV some years ago, it's not so far from the truth. The warder will turn a blind eye to minor infractions in exchange for cooperation in keeping order. And of course, throwing people who have offended against the law together in an indiscriminate way means you very easily criminalise those who may not actually be criminals when they go into prison, but may very well have become criminals by the time they leave. Placing a young offender in the company of an experienced criminal greatly multiplies the chance of reoffending. Prisons are also institutionalising. In prison, the prisoner makes no decisions for himself. His life is organised for him in such a way that a rather infantile dependence is encouraged rather than adult responsibility. And for some kinds of inadequate personality, this is actually appealing, it's actually welcome. People find the institutional life of prison securing for them personally rather than maturing for them personally. Their clothing is taken away and they're given the same sort of uniform some way, sometimes. So they don't even decide what they wear. There are no decisions to make. For such people, prison sometimes feels like a kind of asylum. That's why they reoffend, in order to get back to the institutional safety of their prison. The fifth thing one has to say, though, about prison, of course, is that prisons punish the innocent. I don't mean that sometimes people are falsely imprisoned, though there have been, of course, some cases of that in our recent history in this country, which are very disturbing. But now the innocent I'm speaking about are the families of the criminal. Liffey mentioned the extraordinary high number of children in this country who have a father or a mother in prison. Actually, when you work out the statistics, 500,000 children in this country under the age of 16 will have the experience of a parent who has been in prison for some part of their childhood. Studies on what that does to children are very disturbing. Roger Shaw, the probation officer I mentioned just now, who did research here in Cambridge, was working on that very issue. And the information he came up with is, as I say, extremely disturbing. On the inside, prisons then are experienced as intensely stressful places. Most of us don't realise that. We have the idea, I think, of the person going to prison is rather lucky. They're having a holiday on the state with nothing to do for however many months they're in there. Most of us would be grateful for a little bit of peace and quiet like that. I promise you, that isn't how prisons feel. They are full of frustration and anxiety and helplessness. It's not surprising that psychologists observe all kinds of maladaptive behavior and emotional instability among prisoners, including paranoid fantasy, excessive sleep patterns, depressive reactions. And of course, when you add overcrowding to the normal stresses of prison life, that reinforces and exacerbates those stress patterns, so that angry explosions of emotional energy are not surprising, as again we have sometimes experienced in some of our prisons in the last few years. What help does the Bible give to us, then, in responding to this crisis in prisons in our day? Well, the first place always to look on questions of this sort is the Old Testament law. Because the Bible tells us that one of the purposes the law was given was in order to control the proliferation of evil in a fallen world. When we look to the Old Testament law, to the book of Deuteronomy, we find, as I say, a great deal of information on the question of punishing lawbreakers. Can we have the next slide, Lou? Five observations I'll make from the book of Deuteronomy and from the Old Testament generally about the Old Testament law and what it has to say about punishment. The first is that punishment was primarily an expression of moral outrage and secondarily a deterrent. That comes out in a passage like Deuteronomy 19, verses 19 and 20. You must purge the evil from you, says the text. The rest of the people will hear and be afraid. If you like, this is retribution and deterrent, reaffirmed in the Bible as proper reasons for punishing a criminal. Though retribution is not to be understood in the sense of vengeance on the part of society against the criminal. The Old Testament very firmly, in fact the Bible generally, very firmly says that the reason we are mandated, we are justified in exacting retribution on somebody who commits a crime is because God's law has been broken. And he is the one who is truly offended by what has been done. In the Bible, society is regarded as responsible corporately for the crimes committed within it. Therefore, the Bible requires society to distance itself, to dissociate itself from crime by punishing the criminal. Failure to do this, according to the Bible, will mean that God will have to step in and express his moral reprobation of what has happened by punishing society itself. So the courts are mandated to demonstrate God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Not the wrath of society, but God's wrath on the wrongdoer. And failing to do that, God will exhibit his wrath on the society for its complicity in the crime. That's why we read, purge the evil from among you. If it isn't purged, God will act. There's no provision for protection of the public, specifically in the Old Testament legislation on punishment for crime, although, of course, it has to remember that capital punishment was used more widely in the Old Testament for crimes of violence. And, of course, in that sense, a very violent criminal could not reoffend. Rehabilitation, too, is not explicitly allowed for in the Old Testament law, though, as I should say in a moment, in some ways, the punishment system which the Old Testament law instituted was rehabilitatory in its essence. But more about that in a moment. Punishment, then, was primarily an expression of moral outrage and secondarily a deterrent. Punishment also in the Old Testament could only be levied against the culprit. Explicitly, the Old Testament prohibits involving the relatives of the criminal in the punishment. To say that is something that makes us think about the way prisons work. This wasn't actually the normal way in the ancient Middle East. In the Code of Hammurabi, if, for instance, the son of somebody was killed as a result of an accident on a building site, it was legitimate for the son of the builder, who was responsible for the building site, to be killed. That kind of law is absolutely outlawed in the Old Testament system. Punishment could only be levied against the culprit. You are not to punish the son for the sins of the father, or the father for the sins of the son, says the Old Testament. Thirdly, punishment must always be proportional to the crime. This is the true meaning, you know, of that famous text, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Read in its Old Testament context, that law is not saying, you have a right to private revenge, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. In its Old Testament context, that's an instruction to the judges about making sure that punishment is proportional to the crime. In the Old Testament, there is no right of private revenge. Rather, we are told, as in that passage we read earlier, if you have a dispute, you take it to the judges. The courts are set up precisely to take revenge out of the hands of the private individual and place it in the hands instead of dispassionate justice administered by the state. And that punishment which is administered must be proportional to the crime. That's what an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth means. Fourthly, the Old Testament insists that the criminal's human dignity mustn't be violated by the punishment. Did you notice that in Deuteronomy 25 that we read just now? Flogging was permitted, but only up to a certain number of lashes. Beyond that, it became dehumanizing. It violated the dignity of the individual. He's not to be flogged more than that, or your brother will be degraded in your eyes, says the text. There's a limit to how much humiliation, then, a criminal ought to be forced to endure. But as I said right at the beginning, the most interesting and perhaps the most significant thing of all in ancient Israel was that there were no prisons, nor any provision for prisons. Thinking about those five principles of punishment may actually clarify for us why there were no prisons, when you think about how prisons actually work in practice. The nearest thing, I suppose, you got to a prison in the Old Testament was the so-called city of refuge. If a person was guilty of manslaughter, they had killed someone, not intending to kill them, but through negligence or accident, then they had to flee to one of these cities of refuge, where they had to stay within the city walls until the death of the high priest. But this was not strictly a prison. They were living within the city like everybody else. The reason for this law was really the protection of the prisoner from vengeance by the relatives of the victim. That's why these cities of refuge were set up. They were sanctuaries, not prisons. When you look at the way the prisoners were actually punished in the Old Testament, there's a very important distinction that is drawn. Crimes against property are treated in a very different way from crimes against the person. Crimes against property are universally punished by fines and by restitution. So, for instance, if you steal something, the Old Testament law required that you paid back to the person you stole from four times what you stole from them. Crimes against the person are treated much more seriously. They're punished by corporal or by capital punishment, as are some serious crimes against the social structure. The nearest the Old Testament gets to what we mean by a prison is the institution of slavery. Now, it's very important to realize this was a very different thing from Roman slavery. I think most of us have the idea of a slave from Ben-Hur or Spartacus or something like that. Actually, Jewish slavery in the Old Testament was a very different affair. For a start, it could only last a maximum of 7 years. And there was protective legislation, you'll find it in Leviticus 25 and in Deuteronomy 15, to prevent the exploitation of these so-called slaves. The slave was really a kind of bond servant who paid off his debt, his unpaid fine, for instance, who paid off his debt through what today we might call community service. The word slave sounds rather inhumane, I know, but to the Hebrew institution was in fact rather kind, certainly a great deal kinder than our modern prisons. For the slave was within normal society. He remained there in a household. He did useful work, which enabled him to make restitution to the people he had sinned against. He was unlikely to be corrupted or degraded or criminalized or institutionalized within this context of community service. And most importantly, his family were not penalized with him. He was able to maintain his marital relationship and to parent his children. And when his term of service was complete, the law required that the master of the house should give him a good start financially. In fact, the law actually recognizes that a slave might have become so bonded emotionally to the family he had served, that he might voluntarily become a permanent member of that master's household. And there's actually a little ceremony that's laid down in the Old Testament to permit this. I say again, far more humane certainly as a way of dealing with crimes against property. Certainly no overcrowding, and no cost to the public purse, this ancient Hebrew institution. What about when we come to the New Testament? Of course, when we come to the New Testament, we're no longer dealing with a society ordered by God's law. We're looking at how Christians respond to the phenomenon of prison in a secular society, the Greco-Roman world of the first century. There are several observations that it's useful to make here. The first is that in the New Testament, we find the duty of the state to punish crime is reaffirmed. And there's no criticism of prison as such in any sort of explicit way. Even though prisons didn't exist in the Old Testament, they're accepted institutions in the New Testament. Jesus can even speak in one of his parables of being in prison for debt. There doesn't seem to be any intrinsic antagonism to the idea of prison in the New Testament, even though it wasn't the Old Testament institution. Having said that, though, there is in the New Testament a very clear Christian duty to care for prisoners. Both Jesus in the Gospels and the letter to the Hebrews mention this Christian duty. Now, in all probability, the prisoners immediately in view in both those passages are Christians who are in jail as prisoners of conscience. But interestingly, the early church, and indeed Christians down through all the centuries, haven't limited the relevance of those texts to that situation. They have felt that prisons are fundamentally oppressive places, places that Christians, therefore, ought to bring compassion and hope into. Jesus himself indicated that his message, the message of the gospel, was peculiarly one of hope for prisoners, to preach good news to the poor and freedom for the prisoners, he said. That was his charter in Luke chapter 4. He wasn't necessarily meaning physical freedom, as John the Baptist discovered, of course. Now, Jesus was primarily speaking about spiritual emancipation. But the problem about prison, as we said right at the beginning, is that it destroys the self-esteem of the human individual placed within its walls. It breaks them down so that they're very likely to reoffend, so they have very little hope about themselves as a person. But the gospel gives hope to people. No matter how wicked, no matter how sinful, no matter how many crimes they've committed, the gospel is in the business of giving hope to people, proclaiming freedom to those in bondage. Rather than branding the prisoner as a reject or as an outcast, the gospel seeks to emancipate the prisoner with the thought that God's love can reach even to him or to her, and give them a new beginning. Christians have rightly always felt they had a special duty to communicate that message of hope to prisoners. Back in the last century with Elizabeth Fry, and more recently with Charles Colson, it's possible to trace an honoured tradition of Bible-believing Christians who've been very committed both to prison reform and to evangelism and care within the prison context, and for ex-prisoners. As far as prison reform is concerned, it does seem to me that Liffey is right when she says that it is an outrage that nearly half of the prisoners in this country should be there for crimes against property, crimes as insignificant as the failure to pay fines or television licenses. If we removed those 20,000 prisoners who are in prison simply for crimes against property and implemented community service more in the kind of Hebrew Old Testament way, as a way of those prisoners making restitution to those they have stolen from or defrauded, we would not only ease the financial burden and the overcrowding burden in our prisons hugely, we would treat those people in a way that was far more just according to biblical criteria of justice. We would distinguish crimes against property from crimes against the person in our penal system far more clearly, and that seems to me to be something we desperately need to do. There is something, frankly, rather sick about a society that punishes crimes against property as seriously or more seriously than it punishes crimes against the person. It rather reflects, doesn't it, that so often the law is the instrument of the powerful, the propertied. It suggests that we're more concerned to protect the propertied from the loss of their property than we are concerned to protect the rights of the average citizen against criminal violence or rape. And as for those who are guilty of serious crimes, there's much that could be done, it seems to me, even to make the way they are treated in prison more rehabilitatory. For a start, we might think about how we can separate out the old lags who are wedded to a life of crime from those young offenders, or from those whose offences are of a sexual nature rather than a violent nature. We could try to make sure that in addition to punishing them and making prisons sufficiently unattractive to deter people from wanting to join their number, we offer them some kind of counselling, of therapy, of instruction, of re-education, that may give some hope to them that when they leave, they'll be able to do something in society other than simply become an armed robber.